Moncrief on News Talk.
With the Dacia range. Drive away today with no payments for the first 3 months.
Now, the perennial question of who invented rock and roll has many answers. You might say Elvis or Little Richard, or you might argue that it wasn't a man at all. Sister Rosetta Tharpe made the transition from gospel to 1930s Chicago blues, married with a new way of playing the electric guitar. It's not difficult to trace a direct line from her to the Rolling Stones. Gail Wald is the author of Shout, Sister, Shout, the untold story of rock and roll trailblazer Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And Gail joins us now on News Talk. Afternoon, Gail.
Good afternoon.
Now, I suppose that, you know, her journey to Chicago wasn't that unusual for many blues singers of the time. Though I suppose what is unusual is that her mother took her there.
That's right. I guess that was a little bit unusual. She and her mother migrated from small town Arkansas to Chicago, and soon after they arrived in Chicago, her gifts as a singer and also as a budding guitarist became evident when she played at her church, and said that the preacher had to put her on top of the piano because she was so small, so that everyone in the church could see her play.
Now, and also as for that time and in decades since then, the sight of a woman playing the guitar on stage, was that relatively unusual?
It was, you know, within Rosetta Tharpe's world, within the particular Pentecostal Christian denomination that she belonged to, it wasn't unusual for women to learn stringed instruments, mandolin, banjo, guitar, because those churches believed in praising God with all of the instruments, as they put it. So all kinds of musical expression was encouraged in her church. But within the, you know, broader public sphere, and certainly within popular recorded music, it was very, very unusual. And it's still, arguably, we're still discomfited. There's still something about women playing with, you know, why we expect men to be the players who have the most grace or whatever. I'm not so sure. But it still makes people's jaws drop.
Yeah. And what was the plan to a degree Rosetta would make a career out of singing gospel?
Well, her mother was an evangelist, and so it was important to her to go out and save souls, and she would position herself in Chicago kind of outside of bars and preach and sing. And so her child was useful because a little bit of musical entertainment could get people interested. So mother and daughter spent a lot of Rosetta Tharpe's childhood up until her late teenage years when she got married, traveling that gospel highway and doing preaching.
Right. Okay. Now the wedding, there was a kind of a fake wedding first and then a real wedding.
So probably the height of Rosetta Tharpe's fame in the United States was in the mid to late 40s. She had a big hit in 1944 with her song Strange Things Happening Every Day. She was really at the top of her game. By 1950, things were turning around a little bit, and she needed a way to get back in the public eye. Working with some promoters in Washington, D.C., they had the idea that she would do a concert at a baseball stadium called Griffith Stadium, which is right in the middle of Washington, D.C., and the idea was that she would stage a wedding there. The stadium had been home to what they called church spectaculars. So it was a place where people used the stadium, but never had there been a wedding. There were close to, in different accounts, there were 15 or 20,000 people there. Rosetta Tharpe played after they were married by a local preacher, she and her husband, who may or may not have been secured for the wedding. It's unclear whether the romance preceded the plans or they came together. But after the ceremony, Rosetta Tharpe played from center field in her wedding dress. She had musicians serving as the wedding party, and the people who came to see her were dressed up for a wedding ceremony and brought gifts for her, even though they paid money for tickets to attend. And in my biography, I talk about it as kind of the first, probably one of the first stadium concerts, well before you know, the Beatles come and play New York stadiums.
Yeah. And I suppose the first time somebody sold rights to their wedding as well, if you look at it that way. Plus, also, and I suppose this may be a modern story, the chap she married, Russell Morrison, was that a love match? Because I want to ask you about Maria Knight.
Yeah, well, she and Russell Morrison stayed married until Rosetta Tharpe died in 1973. So I guess, you know, whether it was a love match or not, probably there was some love there.
Mm-hmm.
But Rosetta Tharpe also, according to people who knew her, had relationships with men and women, or at least was attracted to men and women. She wouldn't have used any particular word to call herself. We might call her bisexual today. That's not a word that she would have used. But it was widely rumored that her singing partner from the late 40s through the early 50s, Marie Knight, that they were in a relationship. When I was working on the book, Marie Knight was alive. She passed away several years ago. She told me that that never happened, but other people talked about it.
Okay. To go back in time then a little bit, when did she start to make the transition from gospel into another form of music?
So she came to New York in 1938, and she had been married to a preacher. They were living in southern Florida in the Miami region, and there is this period between 1938 and 39 when kind of everything opens up for her. She probably left Florida to go to New York, both to pursue a career and to get away from an unhappy marriage, maybe both of them combining. But in 1938, she quickly was on major New York stages. She played at Carnegie Hall late 1938. She was on the stage of the segregated Cotton Club. She played the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem, and she also began recording with Decca Records, so a major recording label, and began to have some hits in the late 30s.
Her playing style was very distinctive.
Yeah, and at that time, she wasn't playing, in the late 30s, she wouldn't have been playing an electric guitar. But even when she was playing acoustic guitar, she had a finger-picking style that she would kind of embellish the line of the guitar. It wasn't just strumming in the background. When she began playing electric guitar in the 1940s and recording with electric guitar, her acoustic style translated well to the electric instrument, and she was able to kind of take advantage of all of the different voicings that that instrument provided. And also because she had grown up playing, imagine, in tent revivals in the South, she wouldn't have had amplification. She wouldn't, you know, she grew up having to figure out a way of keeping the people in the back of the church or the back of the hall entertained. So she had a kind of way of moving with her guitar, using her guitar, that translated into a really exciting spectacle for people once she became noted as an electric guitarist.
And as with many performers, many of her peers and many performers since who made that transition out of gospel, was that a difficulty for her? Or was it a difficulty with her mother?
You know, her mother stayed with her mother's entire life. So mother and daughter stuck together. And Rosetta's mother died in 1968, but not until after she had, in her 70s, recorded an album with Dizzy Gillespie. So go figure.
Yeah.
Mother and daughter were talented. But it was very difficult for Rosetta Tharpe. The thing that really distinguishes her is that instead of saying, okay, you know what, I'm going to move to secular music, for example, like a Sam Cooke or like an Aretha Franklin, and I'm going to occasionally move back, or people who move back and forth over the line, she tried to keep her, she straddled that line. And that left people in her church community certainly discomfited. I think people were also obviously really proud of her and happy with her, but she did occasionally do kind of bluesy material that was about carnal love, not spiritual love, and that wouldn't have set well with her audience. And it's not clear how much she liked to perform those kinds of numbers or whether it went along with trying to make a career as a commercial recording artist.
Now, even though, as I understand, she introduced Little Richard when he was still a teenager onto a stage.
She did. And when Little Richard died recently, people recalled that story where he was in the audience and she pulled him up on stage. And according to Richard, she gave him some money that she had. And that meant a big deal to him, that she had given him her blessing and kind of given him like a little gift and said, you know, keep doing what you're doing.
So in the US, at least, she by the 1940s, was she starting to, you know, to fall in popularity a bit? And why was that?
I think probably because by the 1950s, with the rise of rhythm and blues, and also with the popularity of Mahalia Jackson, and then following Jackson, you know, different generations of gospel musicians, that she became, for a lot of young African Americans in the 50s, kind of your mother's music, not the most recent sound. And in the 50s in the US, record labels struggled with how to recast. Could she be recast as a more R&B singer, which never really worked for her. So I think it was as much about the kind of changing of musical styles within gospel and in secular music. But she found a new audience traveling in Europe in the late 50s.
Well, that's the very interesting thing about this, that in the 50s and 60s, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, so many people traveled to the UK, where there was Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones, you know, genuflecting in front of them, and kind of resurrected their careers. She didn't get as much credit as they got.
You know, it's funny. I think if you talk to the musicians, and I had a chance to talk to some musicians for this book, you know, the musicians of that era, they spoke about her. So she didn't get quite the headline treatment that some of the men got. And she, frankly, was not some of those the big star-studded, you know, blues and gospel traveling shows. She wasn't always on those. She actually did a lot of her own independent touring in Europe. But if you ask a Mick Jagger, if you ask an Eric Clapton, if you ask Ginger Baker actually played drums for her in the 50s when she early on was touring in Great Britain. They knew who she was. They paid a lot of attention.
And so then she died quite young, though.
Yeah, she died in her late 50s from complications from diabetes.
And again, did she die penniless, or there seemed to be some sort of controversy over her funeral?
Well, it's unclear. I think because her income, she didn't have children, and her income with Russell Morrison was, you know, entirely dependent on her touring schedule. So she toured until she was actually recording a new album when she died. She was in the middle of doing that. So she was trying to be as active as she could, despite health challenges from diabetes that was really probably not treated adequately. But what the reason that she might appear to have been penniless is that after her funeral, when I was working on my biography of her, she was buried in an unmarked grave in Philadelphia. And the question of kind of why didn't anyone purchase a gravestone for her? I mean, it's not clear where, you know, whose fault that was or how that happened. But I will say that since then, in 2009, she got a gravestone. One of her best friends, who was still alive then, was able to write the epitaph. And so now she's kind of properly acknowledged in Philadelphia, where she lies in rest.
And she was subsequently then inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame so many years later.
That's right. Just 2018, I believe, class of 2018, as an early influence. So that's quite a journey, and probably not something that she could ever have imagined.
Yeah, quite a gap, though, as well, between that and her death. Your book came out, but there was also, I think, a musical on her life.
Yeah, I mean, some of those things have happened after the book. There's a musical called Shout Sister Shout that was most recently in Seattle. There has been a documentary film about her. Maybe we'll see a feature film. We'll see. I think her story would be great. You know, one of the things that you can't capture in a theatrical piece is kind of like what that wedding with tens of thousands of people looked and sounded like. But it is true that for a very long time, from her death in 73, you know, to the turn of the 20th century, she had really faded from the history books. You could look at histories of rock and roll, and even stories of gospel music sometimes, and she just wasn't there. She certainly wasn't in anyone's lists of rock and roll guitarists. Now, that's different. I don't think anyone now can kind of have a list of most important influences on rock and roll and not include her.
Yeah, because I suppose there was a perception that I thought she was a great singer, but that she was deemed to be a better guitar player than a singer.
Yeah, and a lot of people think agree with you that she was a great singer. Her voice definitely changed over her life. But, you know, one of the things, going back to kind of how she was forgotten, in 1971, when she was appearing in England, there was a review of her show, and the reviewer compared her to Elvis, said she was like an Elvis. And what the reviewer did is told, and by the way, Elvis and Rosetta Tharpe were still alive then. And what the reviewer did was get it totally backwards. Elvis grew up at Rosetta's feet. When he first went to record at Sun Studio, he warmed up with a song of hers. So, you know, it was Elvis who learned from Rosetta Tharpe, but because of the ways that race and gender kind of affect the ways we remember, Elvis became the bigger star. So that even in 1971, a reviewer could say she looks like Elvis rather than Elvis looks like she does.
That's so interesting. Actually, one of our listeners, Rob, has an interesting, it's a more general question. Do professors of music have a specific rule as to when one genre becomes another? Like, when or where does gospel or blues become rock and roll? When did funk give birth to hip hop? There's many more examples to that, I would have thought.
I love that question. It's a great question. The fact is that most musicians will tell you they hate genre names, and they actually don't believe in them. And I think a lot of popular music scholars kind of feel the same way. The fact is that those genre categories, they serve a certain utility, you know, when you want to know what does it sound like. So they give us general descriptions, but musically they don't hold much water. And there's a point at which it's really impossible to kind of categorize really most musicians, even those that we think, you know, that musicians are always they have big ears. They're always listening. They're always borrowing. And those categories serve the recording industry in many ways more than they serve any of us. So the answer is, yeah, the categories are always blurry.
And I suppose especially when it comes to the charts and categories of music, that's always been highly controversial. I think Rosetta's first big hit was on, they were called the race charts.
That's right. That's right. You know, or even if you take like a blues musician like Robert Johnson, one of the things that you can find out or you know, kind of is that those musicians, when they went into the recording studio, they had large repertoires. They could do popular, you know, songs from the Tin Pan Alley hit parade. Mm. They were shaped in the recording studio because of notions of who their listening public was and what people wanted, in this case, from an African-American musician. But that had nothing to do with, or maybe little to do with, the repertoire that those musicians mastered. They, in many cases, they got sold as blues artists because it wasn't okay for them to produce, you know, kind of more popular song.
Yeah, or indeed, so, you could almost say a lot of, like, when you go back as far as Robert Johnson, it's folk music.
That's right.
Really. No, we kind of started talking about her in Chicago, but prior to that, because she did come from a place called Cotton Plant, was that actually a plantation? And do we know anything about her life there?
Yeah, we do know a little. When I was working on the book, I called up the Chamber of Commerce and Cotton Plant and said, who's the oldest person in town? Hmm. And I got to talk to the oldest person in town, who was then 97, who was actually would have been older than Rosetta Tharpe. And he was able to be a great source for me about Cotton Plant. So at the turn of the century, or in 1915, when she was born, Cotton Plant was a prosperous little town, kind of not that far from Memphis, on the other side of the Mississippi. And she would have grown up in a town that had a small black middle class. It had five churches. It had an opera house in town. So this was a kind of bustling and economically very, very varied, variable little town that changed a lot, obviously, through the course of the 20th century, but wouldn't have provided many opportunities for a black woman to do anything but domestic service or field work. I mean, it's possible that her mother decided to move to Chicago because she felt a calling to preach or to evangelize. And it's possible that that was so scorned in her small town that she felt that she had a better chance of doing that in a city. So not so much about needing to get away from a particular although economic hardship had to have had something to do with it, but combined with an ambition to have a voice within her religion.
We look forward to seeing the movie, Gail, and thank you so much for speaking with us today. Gail Wild is a professor of English at George Washington University and the author of Shout, Sister, Shout, the untold story of rock and roll trailblazer Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Church people say they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day.
Moncrief on News Talk
with the Dacia Duster. Shockingly affordable, and now with 3 months deferred payments too.